Hey, I got to talk to my friend Simon Aubrey today about event-driven architecture. He's been around the Kafka space for about 5 years, which is kind of a long time, and he wanted to take some time to talk to that younger version of himself and offer some advice. What would Simon say today to younger Simon if he had it to do all over again? Well, you get to listen in on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am, as always, your host, Tim Berglund, and I'm joined in the virtual studio, which is a virtual studio spanning the whole planet. This is from the other side of the planet relative to where I am right now, by Simon Aubrey. Simon, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. I'm very excited to join you today, and thanks for inviting me.
You got it. I should say welcome back to the show. This is a returning guest, as we say, the triumph of hope over experience. So great to have you back. If you haven't heard Simon's previous appearance on Streaming Audio, of course, is linked in the show notes. Simon has a background as an Oracle DBA. We're still friends, but he's been an Oracle DBA and then migrated from there to developer, to data engineer. And you are now principal data engineer at ThoughtWorks. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So I think we all make a bit of a weaving path into IT. But yes, I did have to start life a good couple of decades ago as both a Java developer and an Oracle DBA. And
it's okay. I wrote today before I was a Java developer. So.
I think we all make a bit of a meandering path, but yeah, definitely very excited to work in the data industry. And as a career choice, it's been pretty exciting because it's given me the opportunity to work both in Australia, through Asia Pacific, and throughout Europe. So yeah, definitely working in the data space and working in some of those sort of challenging big data areas. It's been super exciting to get exposed to a variety of problems. As a ThoughtWorks consultant, I get the opportunity to work with companies who have super ambitious goals. They're essentially clients who have like really, really tough IT problems. And it's a real pleasure to be able to sort of stay ahead with that disruptive thinking and bringing software consultancy and pioneering tools to come and solve some really ambitious challenges. And on a personal level, working as a ThoughtWorks consultant gives me the opportunity to work with an awesome team of really passionate and diverse and leading edge software engineers. So I'm conscious that this is a streaming audio podcast, so it's probably worth giving just a tiny flavor of some of the my exposure to Kafka and an awesome streaming platform. So I had the first exposure to Kafka, call it about 5 or 6 years ago. That was very much in that sort of customer experience area, website analytics, website traffic analysis. And that was fantastic. It was my first exposure to the fantastic streaming platform that is Kafka. And they very much moved into other projects that were highly available streaming solutions, everything from single customer platforms, vehicle monitoring systems. And for the last few years, I've worked as a consultant, working on a variety of use cases, everything from transport, fintech, energy sector trading. So yeah, it's been quite a diverse collection of Kafka and event-driven applications.
Love it. I want to talk to you today about event-driven architectures. And that's a thing that if I feel like we're, number one, standardizing on that phrase, by the way. It seems like that's emerging as the label that we use to talk about this family of approaches to building systems. And it's a thing we definitely talk about on this show, but we don't always, if you just look back through the catalog, it's not that often that we have an episode where we say, hey, we're going to talk about event-driven architecture. So let's do that. First of all, why is that of interest to you? You work with Kafka, you build systems, maybe it's obvious, but specifically.
Yeah. So I find event-driven architecture, it's a really interesting way of thinking about how to solve problems in very large, complicated ecosystems. So typically enterprises that have different teams, different business units, and they need to be able to build solutions together. And it's probably worth pointing out that event-driven architecture isn't particularly new. Apparently, it's been around for a good 20, 25 years or so. But what is new is essentially people's expectations when they're dealing with their bank or their energy company. I don't know about you, Tim, but my expectations of dealing with my bank are different than they were 5 years ago and definitely 10 years ago. I have expectations when I buy something that it's going to be fast and immediate and quick. And I don't think anyone's really got tolerance for slow systems that are sort of batch orientated. So I think event-driven architecture has really come into its own.
I sometimes joke about the days of allow 4 to 6 weeks for delivery are behind us. And, you know, young-ish people might only know that if they watch vintage TV or something, right? That phrase, it doesn't even mean anything anymore. But more than that, as I say, you know, you've got a phone in your pocket and you actually expect it to wiggle when you need to know about something. Like if something has changed, you talk about banking, if there is some sort of asynchronous event with respect to your accounts at the bank, you expect a notification. That's just how it is. So the systems behind all of that need to be able to deliver real-time results. And the developers and the architects who are building these systems, that pressure is on you, right? Like you need to make a system that can interact with the consumer now. And well, we need new tools to do that because that wasn't a requirement 30 years ago when the received paradigms were being developed, when they were an innovative new paradigm, you know, so... In other words, lengthy way of saying yes, real time matters.
Yes. And those expectations are continually growing. I was interested when my children the other day bought something online, and then my daughter 2 hours later was hanging out by the postbox expecting it to have arrived. So yeah, those expectations are growing all the time.
Yeah. That's just the reality that children are growing up in now. Let's talk about what event-driven means to you, or what not to you, the significance. How is event-driven architecture significant to you? What are the different things that people mean by event-driven?
Yeah. So at the end of the day, event-driven is very much the building solutions, so they're both independent and reactive. And it's almost worth starting off by giving a bit of an example. And I wanted to use an example from one of my colleagues, Sarah Tara Pawala, who uses the example of a restaurant, and how the different areas of a restaurant need to coordinate with one another. And you could use the restaurant example as a proxy for thinking about some of the complexity that a typical enterprise might see. But I like a restaurant example because it's both easy to conceptualize, and I like going to restaurants. So it motivates me to think about business domains and business problems that way. So if you're ever talking to a product owner or a business stakeholder, quite often they're describing their business along the lines of when something happens, something else needs to happen. And it might be a customer clicks on a website and we want to send them a welcoming email. But if you think about the complexity that builds up across an organization or across a restaurant, this sort of point-to-point solution gets very, very out of hand quite quickly. So if we were thinking about a restaurant example, you can think about all the independent areas of a restaurant and how they need to coordinate against each other. You might have the maitre d' who welcomes people to the restaurant. You might have the wait staff who need to interact with the customers, and the kitchen who are preparing food orders. And then there's the stock room who needs to worry about inventory, and the cashier who needs to itemize bills. Now, we could design our restaurants so each of these teams need to talk directly to each other, but it's going to become chaotic quite quickly. It's going to be very, very difficult for the kitchen to optimize the way that they work, or the wait staff, how they might interact and worry about the number of wait staff they have on the floor, if each of these teams need to talk directly to one another. So if we think about event-driven architecture, we can think about how these teams might be able to optimize internally, but be able to build a really, really highly effective restaurant by just talking about things that have happened in their own domain. So if you can think about someone has sat down at a restaurant, they might sit and interact with the wait staff, and they might order fish. And that might just be an event that has happened on a message bus. And then the kitchen can react to that event and actually start thinking, well, someone's ordered fish. Maybe I need to start cooking fish on the fryer. What's really good about this sort of paradigm is that you can start thinking about this from an enterprise perspective. You can start thinking of what's necessary when we're talking about communicating across the enterprise, essentially events that have happened. But you can also start seeing ways that each team can be quite efficient. The kitchen staff might be able to locally optimize how they organize their kitchen. The wait staff might be able to organize themselves. And each team can be essentially provided just an interface, or what we might in DDD call a bounded context, which is essentially the interface to each of those teams. And you as a consumer, you don't need to worry about how each of those teams have optimized themselves. You just have to worry about the amazing experience that you're going to have at that restaurant.
That makes sense. And I love the restaurant analogy, because you can just play with it a little bit and think, it is extremely likely that everyone who is employed by that restaurant will have at least facility in a common language. They might not all be native speakers of the same language, just in a typical cosmopolitan city. That's not going to work out that way. But everybody's going to be able to speak, if it's in Sydney, English. If it's in Denver, English. But each of those groups is going to have a way of communicating that's optimized for their work. So, you know, like everybody could be using Protobuf, but the domains are different and the messages are different, and we need to define some standard interfaces. So we're all speaking English, but wait staff have a jargon, and certainly the kitchen, there's a very specialized jargon, or like argot, going on back there. And those are good. Those emerge within those groups for reasons. They're actually an optimization for the way those people communicate. But they're a sub-optimization for communicating between groups. So, to your point, all the point-to-point interfaces are going to become expensive if everybody needs to be able to locally optimize to their jargon and maintain everybody else. It'd be like Star Wars, where everybody speaks their own language and somehow everybody manages to understand it. So, like, you can produce one and you can receive all of them. It's not how any group of language users really works. I like the restaurant analogy.
Yeah. And there's a natural sort of carry on to this level of thinking when we're talking about microservices in an enterprise. I think one of the mistakes I've definitely made in the past is spending far too much time talking about the right size of a microservice or the right size of a team to support a microservice. You know, should it be a particular sized repo? Should it be optimized to a particular language? Should you be able to feed that team with two pizzas?
We can bike shed that, Simon. I'm confident we can bike shed this question hard.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, like many things, if you ask 10 developers, you'll get 12 answers. But maybe the better question to ask is, well, how big is the interface to that microservice? And if we're thinking about event-driven architecture, it's essentially what is the surface of that bounded context? And to your point earlier, Tim, it doesn't really matter to me as wait staff how the kitchen is optimized, as long as they get their job done and they meet particular service level agreements or on being able to turn around orders, and they are in turn supported by the stockroom who need to bring supplies to the kitchen. We can all play like adults. We can all work together, but we don't need to get too coupled to the inner workings of each of those teams across the restaurant.
Yeah. I like it. Now, we were talking before we started recording. I saw a meme. We'll call it a meme. I mean, I guess it was just an image, but there was a caption in the tweet. So it was like, it was a meme of adult Kermit the Frog talking to baby Kermit. And I forget if baby Kermit actually has a proper name, because I think they're contemporaneous characters. Like there was Kermit and there was baby Kermit. So baby Kermit had to have some unique name. But whatever. It's grown Kermit talking to this little frog. And the caption I gave it was, when you first read a Wikipedia article about internal family systems, might link to that in the show notes, might not. It's a little obscure. Like five people are going to get that and you're going to cry. But you, Simon, thinking of you speaking to younger Simon, and we don't get to be, get much younger because this has been 5 years for you that you've been in this, I guess, in Kafka, and maybe as you pointed out, event-driven architectures are older than that, but they were, I think it's fair to say, a bit player, at least in the enterprise, prior to kind of now, you know, the last few years. But as you, as 2021 Simon, look back to maybe 2017 Simon, what are some lessons you'd want to, you know, speaking empathetically and openly to that younger version of yourself who was doing the best he could at the time, making decisions, you know, trying to survive, what would you say to that younger Simon?
Yeah. And that's a terrific question, Tim. I would love to be able to post messages in a bottle back to my younger self. But yeah, definitely there's things that over time I've learned, and both these are either mistakes or learnings that I have made. But I've also seen these sort of characteristics pop up in other areas. I think one of the first things I would love to emphasize to a younger former myself is that there's a really important distinction between messages and events. This might be my background of I'm old enough to remember three-tier architectures where an application was heavily integrated at a database level, and then we would try and solve some of the coupling problems with exciting terms such as SOA and RPC and event services buses. So that might have somewhat influenced my early thinking when I got involved in event-driven systems. But back to the point, messages and events, they're fundamentally different. A message is essentially a command to do something, and typically it's a message that's a point-to-point payload that's specifically targeted to a service at, where there's the expectation that a system's going to respond. So if I was sending a message to Tim, I might ask Tim to send an email or scan a document or perform a service. And that's very much of a command-orientated system. And that puts an obligation on me as a sender to wait until Tim has confirmed that that action has happened. And that provides
Gotta make sure it's happened.
Oh, absolutely. I really enjoy talking to you, Tim. But if we're doing this frequently and often, it might be a bit of a burden for both yourself and myself to send direct messages to one another.
I'd get tired of it, yes.
Oh, and absolutely. Whereas if we talk about event-driven thinking, we're talking about not so much this obligation to put a command into a system. We're talking about a statement of fact. And events then get persisted in a replayable stream history, such as something incredible like Kafka. And then downstream consumers can respond to those events. So if we use this restaurant analogy again, I might put an event onto a Kafka topic that says, customer has walked in the door in past tense. It's a statement of fact. It's non-disputable. It's an immutable event that's definitely happened. And a consumer can look at that event and then react appropriately. Perhaps we'll want to sign that customer up to an email list, or perhaps we might want to sit them in a restaurant or give them a wine menu. But we're very much talking about an event which is a concrete statement of fact. It's happened, an event has happened in the past. And we've, as a producer of that event, I'm not particularly concerned about the downstream consumers who need to react to it. So it really sort of simplifies that. The architecture that's going to come off the back of this. So this sounds very, very subtle, but it really wasn't clear to a younger Simon that a message is essentially a command and an expectation that's going to happen. An event is just a statement of fact. And getting that concept clear from the get-go could have actually solved a lot of sort of design problems and a lot of sort of implementation friction.
Gotcha. I like the, this is a point I've tried to make about asking, waiting to ask, waiting, trying to find out whether a thing happened. People new to event-driven architecture will have a lot of command and response topics in Kafka. They'll actually build that into Kafka. Like, here is my topic telling you a thing to do. You go do it asynchronously, except I'm waiting to make sure you did it, which, you know, if you go back to people and, you know, a restaurant, you don't treat adults that way. They will resent you. It will not last. You know, they will make that stop by leaving the organization or checking out or something. You know, some bad thing is going to happen to that relationship between the people. And with event-driven architectures, you don't treat services that way. You produce an event and you expect everyone else to be an adult. Now, just like in a restaurant, somebody's looking over this, right? There's usually the manager walking around saying, are you enjoying your meal? Is everything going well? You know, just kind of making sure things are going okay. And you could have metrics for how long it takes to run food or between order and food delivery and all that. You still measure, you still observe the system, but from one service to another, you don't wait to make sure they've done the right thing. That's just not how it works. That's a non-sustainable way of getting the job done.
I mean, absolutely. And perhaps a real world implementation of this is when we're talking about really, really complicated financial services systems, which over time sort of flourish and have more and more bells and whistles. And this is a fantastic use case for an event-driven architecture. One EDA platform that I worked on had a quite an important step in the flow, which was essentially address validation. Now, this sounds like a very, very straightforward task. Someone puts in an address into a free text field. But as you can imagine, addresses are quite unique, and that has quite a material impact.
They're actually terrible.
Yes, absolutely. So being able to turn a free text field into an address, both so you can actually point to it on a map, but also infer other things such as what's the property worth, what's the risk of fire or flood or burglary. And I don't know about other jurisdictions, but in Australia, if you can actually localize an address down to a very, very fine area, you can actually stamp your outgoing envelopes with a particular barcode, and that makes postage much cheaper. So there's impacts both large and small when you're doing address verification. Now, one of the systems I worked on had this quite important but somewhat convoluted process to do this address validation. And when we initially modeled this system, we probably over-indexed on all of the responses back from that address validation service. So there might be a confidence score returned or a timeout or an error or some sort of back pressure measure. And our instinct was to go and add all of these messages back into our Kafka topic because, of course, someone might want to know the HTTP response code or the number of messages or the amount of back pressure applied to this service. But that's very much comes back to the what is an important event to model and what is a command that you're expecting someone to consume. And one of the discoveries when we started building out this system was we ended up putting what we might term passive-aggressive events into our queue. So they were events, but there was almost like this implicit expectation that someone was going to react to those events. So it wasn't just a nicety that we're getting an error something from a service. There was almost like this implicit expectation that someone was going to reroute that message and a human was going to get involved in the loop. And in terminology, I love this passive-aggressive event. It's a statement of fact, but there was a strong expectation that someone was going to react to it. And that's sort of a bad smell when building out.
Someone in particular, like you're waiting almost for that response.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think I'm going to use that. I really like that. I was going to say, talk about the difference between choreography and orchestration. That's something I've talked about recently on the show, but always good to get another angle on that. So how do you think about those two things?
Oh, and this is a terrific question. And again, something I wish I had clarified to myself earlier in the EDA journey. So orchestration is all about something, a single entity coordinating as a controller all of the communication. So in an IT sense, this might be a controller module that's responsible for calling all of the microservices in turn. Sometimes when we're talking about a more general example, we're talking about a conductor in front of a music pit. Each of the musicians are highly talented, highly skilled individual players, but it's the conductor in front of the orchestra who is actually setting the time, the tempo, and keeping everyone running together. So this is fantastic in some circumstance, but you can imagine that if you've got 20 musicians, this would work. If you've got hundreds of thousands of musicians scattered throughout the world, putting a conductor in front of everyone might become infeasible quickly. So that's the space of orchestration. It's where you've got tolerance for an individual controller for all the activity, which in some cases and some problem spaces is the right answer. But obviously that induces a level of friction and a level of coupling across individual teams. So the converse of that is choreography, or essentially event-driven response architecture. And that's where systems take independent action based on events that they might find in a streaming platform. And when we're talking about event-driven architecture, we're really implying that this is a choreographed sequence of events. Now, this has a number of advantages because, as in our restaurant example before, we don't need to directly couple systems to one another. We can have our kitchen natively reacting to orders as they come in. We can have the stock room reacting to events that have happened in a service history. And event-driven choreography gives us a level of independence across those services and a level of flexibility when we're talking about uplift, changes, efficiency. So one of the advantages of choreography is simply that you're treating all your services as adults and they can mature and evolve independently from one another. It also has a great operational uplift in that if a service goes down, it only affects that one service generally, and they can correct and think about bringing their service back to life, and it doesn't necessarily impact other services. So both from a resilience sense and a team independence sense, choreography for non-trivial systems is an easier way to evolve enterprise systems.
You, being a thought worker, have probably read or heard or thought a little bit about evolutionary architecture. Do you see a connection between those two? And is it, cards on the table. I do. And I think it's an intimate connection. Is that an overstated case? Do you think event-driven architecture is the other side of the coin from evolutionary architecture? What do I need to get from one to the other?
This is a really interesting question. I need to confess that I only made it three chapters in to the Neil Ford and the Rebecca
Neil's
Parsons
book.
Tome.
Yeah, Neil and Rebecca, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a really good challenge to think through of how systems evolve over time. We are constantly looking at applications that have sort of stayed true to their course and obviously are battle-tested, but we need to be able to evolve them. And to me, event-driven architecture really gives that sort of independence for teams to optimize locally and talk about how you can actually do uplift and efficient deployments where necessary. I don't think I've got a good answer for you, Tim.
Okay. Hey, yeah. Good enough.
Yeah.
You had said something about the decoupling that EDA affords you allows services to mature and evolve independently. And I think that's the key, because that's like the story that we've been telling ourselves about microservices for almost a decade now, that we were going to be able to. And, you know, the initial experience was, well, no, we're not able to. You know, you have to release them all at the same time and in a particular order. And it was this bad thing. So I think now what we get is something like the ability of services to truly evolve with only the, you know, the necessary coupling, which would be schema. You know, you got to know what, you got to know what an event is. You got to have some kind of common language, how the event is formatted. But not only so can individual services evolve on their own, but new services can grow up. They can be innovated upon logs of events that are pre-existing. So I think there's a connection there, and that's just something worth exploring, I guess, more as we move forward.
Yeah, and you're spot on. And maybe this is, again, a lesson I could teach my former self when it comes to who is in charge of schema evolution. And coming from a traditional DBA background, there was almost like this innate need to control everything across an organization. And maybe it comes from the bad old days of needing to build an entity relationship diagram to talk about how to model everything. But when I first got exposed to schemas and schema registries and schema evolution, my first feel was this would be something that would be best centralized in an organization. And I can only say that 5 years of history has shown me that that is the worst analogy. So don't think about your schema registry as you do a centralized database. So a much more enlightened Simon would say that the right approach is to treat all your services as independent and mature adults, and just set some basic ground rules about schema ownership and schema evolution. So the basic one would be allow producers to be run in a forward compatible mode and let them evolve gracefully forward, conscious of the fact that there will be a downstream consumer who won't appreciate a mandatory field disappearing. So obviously things like putting your schema registry in forward compatible mode just sets some basic ground rules so teams can mature and evolve at an appropriate rate without causing too much friction.
Love it. Does that sounds like the accidental message bus anti-pattern that you came close to describing there. And I've got a slide. I don't use it too much these days, but I've used it in the past, that it was two slides. You know, this is the garbage point-to-point spaghetti of all this integration. And, oh, now it's okay. Everything just talks to Kafka. And from A to B, architects of a certain age will say, that looks like a enterprise service bus. You said message bus, but, you know, the accidental ESB anti-pattern. Why is this not an ESB, you know? There are answers. I think they're related to what you just said, but talk to me about younger Simon accidentally building a message bus.
Yes. So I love one of my colleagues who once described this as no problem in the world can't be made worse by the introduction of an ESB. So ESBs, yes, ESBs have had their time, but it's very much perpetuates this concept of messages need to be delivered and we need to hang around until those messages are consumed. And they're very command orientated and directive, and introduces all sorts of interesting failure modes if you're talking about multiple consumers on the same message. So it adds to all sorts of fun and joy when you're talking about failure modes. But more importantly, there beyond the high-level architecture and the best intentions, there really are real-world considerations when you're talking about failure points across services. So one system that I had, it was actually a delightful pleasure to build this because it was a really interesting problem space. But when we're talking about doing OCR on a document, we're talking about sending physical papers off to an area, they're scanned, you're pulling out the metadata, you're describing the text, and you're being able to tag all of that information. But one sort of bad slippery slope on this project was we ended up putting a lot of commands back into our messages. And again, we fell down this slippery slope of almost wrapping putting events in, but they were implicit commands. So we fell down this slippery slope again of passive aggressive events, and before long had ended up building essentially the sins of the past, an ESB on top of Kafka. And that was started off with very, very short-term reactionary. How are we going to get around this sort of OCR failure? This is sort of important. We need to rescan these documents. It's time specific. And before we knew it, we were putting all sorts of commands back into our Kafka topics. And that was just a recipe for disaster. So the right answer is be good to the event-driven paradigm and just really, really think about, well, what is appropriate for a local state store? What is a process you're just prepared to rerun if it sort of aborts halfway through? And what are the true significant messages that you actually want to, the true significant events that you actually want to persist? And in the case of an OCR document, you can really talk about my intent is I've received a physical document. I want a downstream system to successfully scan it and itemize all of the things on that page. But that's very much where we want to go with event-driven architecture, separating the event that has happened versus a downstream system that needs to do something important.
So having advised Simon 2017, coming back to Simon 2021, having been through all those things, what would you now say, if you could summarize it in a list of a few things, that you advocate for as some fundamentals of event-driven architecture?
Well, I'd probably break this down into advocating for particular technical patterns and particular sort of training and uplift patterns. So from a technical perspective, obviously I love and have confidence with Kafka and the Kafka ecosystem. So if I'm given an opportunity to use Kafka and the schema registry and all of the great things on top of that platform, I definitely advocate for building an EDA on top of Kafka, just because you've got a really, really great way of doing stream processing. It's obviously got all of the observability, flexibility, and scalability you would want from an event-driven platform. When we're actually talking about the high-level implementation, again, the ground rules that you actually want to put in place for a large enterprise, I'd consider it's kind of important to just set some really, really basic ground rules. Events are always in the past tense. Something has happened. A customer has arrived. An order has been taken. All of the events should be named in the past tense, just to really solidify the fact that these are events and not messages. I'd also advocate very much for stamping an event with a correlation ID. The moment that an event enters a system, you want to put a GUID on it or just something unique. So as it traverses the system, you can always help with your observability platform later on by having a tracking GUID. And where dates and times, again, really, really important. Disks are cheap. So the more header information you can add, things like event production time and event creation time, which may potentially be different, and originating system, stamping all of these into the payload just as a good citizen helps with being able to track and build reliable and observable systems down the track. And don't be tempted to break up these events too early. Having coarse grain events that later on you choose to break down is a much easier path than trying to optimize too early in a process and getting too micro with the size of the events. It's much easier to break events down into their components or discard events that you're not particularly interested in, rather than trying to recreate a whole bunch of very, very low-level events. And from the people side, I've also learned that it's just important to anticipate that there's sometimes going to be a bit of an uplift when we're talking about introducing event-driven architecture and streaming platforms into an organization. Most people are really, really enthusiastic to embrace technology, but do need to be guided and do essentially just need to know where there's watch points in both learning and discovery. And if I look at myself, I've made a number of mistakes and I've seen those mistakes come out in other areas. So just the distinction between event-driven versus messaging, size of events, bounded context, all of these things are lessons that we can share with one another. So hopefully my learnings and my mistakes aren't then relearned by another generation. So that training and uplift and just having a bit of a willingness to just understand the context or the important architecture principles before you get too involved in an EDA deployment.
My guest today has been Simon Aubrey. Simon, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Tim, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for your time.
Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? Some free Confluent Cloud. Use the promo code 60PDCAST, that's 60PDCAST, to get an additional $60 of free Confluent Cloud usage. Be sure to activate it by December 31st, 2021, and use it within 90 days after activation. Any unused promo value after the expiration date is forfeit. And there are a limited number of codes available, so don't miss out. Anyway, as always, I hope this podcast was useful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me on Twitter at TL Berglund. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out on Community Slack or on the Community Forum. There are sign-up links for those things in the show notes if you'd like to sign up. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover it, especially if it's a 5-star review. And we think that's a good thing. So thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.